We've been working through the book of Mark, and this morning we're in chapter 6. We're going to look at verses 30 through 44, which is, this is the story of Jesus feeding the 5,000, and this is a story probably, if you've gone to church for very long or know the Bible very well at all, this is a really familiar story to you. And the great thing is, even if you don't know a thing about the Bible, this is probably one of those stories that you've probably heard about, where Jesus miraculously takes out of 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish, and he feeds 5,000 people. It's probably more like well, there's considerably more than 5,000. I was probably just counting the men. So there's also women and children. There are a lot of people. And when he's all done, there's 12 basket loads of food still left over. So this amazing event. One of the things that's kind of cool about this story, a lot of there are 4 books about Jesus' life in the Bible, that kind of his autobiographies, I guess you might say, written by a couple of his friends and disciples. So there's the book of Matthew, the book of Mark, the book of Luke and John. Each one of them sort of has their own perspective on different things. There's different stories throughout each one. Sometimes there's overlapping stories that you can read a little bit about one story here. There's another emphasis in one of the other stories. What's interesting about this story is it's one of the rare stories that's in all 4 of the books. And it's no wonder why, because this was such an incredible event that it took a lot of people a lot of time to write and tell everybody about it because it was such a big deal. It seems like if you've been following us the last couple of months, and if you've been reading the Bible very much on your own, one of the things that you notice is everywhere Jesus goes, he's sort of shaking up life as people know it. And very oftentimes, in a good way, think about some of the stories we've heard so far about the absolute miraculous life change that people have encountered by being around Jesus. A couple weeks ago, we talked about a woman, a girl, a 12-year-old girl who was dead, and the grief that her family and friends were stricken with. And Jesus comes and raises that girl to life. And along with that story, there was a story of a woman who, because of a health condition she had, totally alienated from the rest of society. She had no part in the larger culture at large. And Jesus comes and heals her, and by bringing her healing, restoring her, allows her to experience all that life is supposed to be about. Jesus calms the storm, and almost every week we've been reading about these miracles where Jesus comes and brings restoration and a new sense of joy to people's life. One of the things that I think we call these things miracles a lot of times, and one of the things I want you to think about today is, could it be that, you know, for us, we think of a miracle as like we live in this universe and we understand there's these laws that sort of govern our existence. And we see that Jesus comes in from time to time and sort of breaks the normal reality of those laws. And when we see him do that, we call that a miraculous event. I want you to consider, though, that maybe we have it wrong. Maybe what is real life, the way life is supposed to be, is not those miraculous moments, but maybe Jesus is reminding us of how life really was intended to be. Maybe the reality that we all experience of pain, hurt, suffering, death, disappointment, toil in life, maybe that's not how God's original plan for us was. Maybe reality is as Jesus intended it to be. That he comes in, and what we call a miracle is actually Jesus restoring things back to the way they were supposed to be. And see, I think you have good evidence for that. You go back to the beginning of the Bible and think about this. Before sin ever entered into the world, how did God create it? It wasn't that we weren't supposed to work, but work was not supposed to be the kind of toil that it is now. It was supposed to be fulfilling. A great sense of satisfaction and enjoyment with the work that we were doing. We were supposed to have this unique relationship with God and with other people, a very fulfilling sense of relationship. Remember, the very first place of community that God made for us to experience all that life was supposed to be about is family. And I can tell you, as a pastor, there's a lot of people that the last place they feel a sense of fulfillment and enjoyment in life is with their family. See, all of these things have gone awry, and my thinking is the way the world is today that we call reality is actually not how God intended life to be. And one of the things we're going to find out in this story is, I think Jesus, just by looking at the way he lives and looking at some of the principles that guides his life and how he lives, we can be reminded of what it looks like for us to be able to enjoy sort of the richness of life that God originally intended for us to experience. One of the great purpose verses in the Bible is this verse, John 10:10, where Jesus talking of, sees himself as a shepherd guiding lost people. Jesus does this compare and contrast thing. He says, the thief comes only to steal, kill, and destroy. So you might say, whenever you see death, destruction, alienation, all of those sort of things, there is an author that does want to create that kind of a reality in the world today. And that person is the thief. Obviously, he's talking about Satan here. But notice what Jesus says. He says, my purpose is to do what? Is to give them a rich and satisfying life. And I'm convinced that this wasn't just Jesus' idea just for those few people that he interacted with, but this was God's plan for all of us to be able to restore and experience some of that richness that he originally intended in life. So I want to go through and examine what are some of those keys to experience a rich life that Jesus exemplifies for us in this story. So remember, a lot of times we hear this, the feeding of the 5,000, and we just sort of jump to the end and go, wow, look at that miraculous stuff, and we forget all the things that happen in between then. The story actually starts out not having any intent to feed anybody but himself and his friends. In verse 31, it says, Then, because so many people were coming and going, they didn't even have a chance to eat. And he said to them, come with me by yourselves to a quiet place and get some rest. If you've been reading along with us here, you know that the press of life, the demands of people, is swamping Jesus. I love this. And they didn't have a chance to sit down and enjoy a meal because there's so many demands, so many people's needs to minister to. So they went away by themselves in a boat to a solitary place. So I'm convinced that one of the keys to enjoying the kind of rich life that God intended for us is to be able to rest. Be able to find places where we can enjoy and get away from the hustle and bustle of the craziness of life. And this really, I mean, this sounds simple, but you know, I know in my life, and I know a lot of other people, that they feel guilty if they set everything aside to be able to go and sit and do something by themselves for an hour, to be able to get away from the press of life. I mean, Jesus, no doubt, he had a lot of demands on his life, and I think it's probably like you. Isn't there always one more good thing to be done? Isn't there always one more person to serve, one more need to be met? Absolutely. But that doesn't mean that Jesus didn't put things aside to be able to experience rest. And this shouldn't come as a surprise to us. If you think back to the beginning of the Bible, and remember, God himself set aside a whole day just to rest and enjoy the fruits of his labor, to be able to enjoy what he had been doing. Remember, this idea of rest is something that God intended for us as well. This is a passage out of the book of Exodus where God's telling Moses, he says, you're taking the people, and this is the picture. You're taking them out of Egypt. And what were they in Egypt? In slavery. They were in bondage. And he's bringing them out of slavery, out of bondage, into freedom, this promised land. And the promised land was supposed to be a place where what? Where God could meet their needs, physical and spiritual needs. They would look to him in a new kind of way. And when they did that, they would experience the kind of freedom that God originally intended for them. And that would bring the kind of rest that God wanted for his people. Think of King David, who, you know, this guy had money, power, everything in life. And David, you know, he's got palaces, he had retreats, all these places he could go to. And David says again and again in the Psalms, my rest, the place where I find, and this is the idea of contentment with life in the Hebrew. He finds that where? In God. And I love what he says here. In God alone is the one place he found that. And of course, Jesus says, come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Man, if there isn't a cry that we all have in our life, give me peace. And Jesus comes and he says, hey, you can experience. In fact, he says, this is part of why I came. I think it's easy to assume that Jesus is just this busy guy. He's got all these demands, all these people's needs to meet, and he never took a break. But remember, nothing could be farther from the truth. The very first chapter of the book of Mark says, very early in the morning while it was still dark, Jesus went away to a lonely place to pray. He left everybody. And his disciples come to him and they say, dude, are you crazy? All these people, all this stuff going on. Jesus had just had a great first day of ministry, and now he's off in the wilderness hiding, and they don't get it. And what Jesus says, he says, we're going to move from here to go somewhere else. Jesus' commitments of what he does with his time aren't driven by what everybody else expects from him. He was totally willing to lay all the people's expectations aside to go and have some rest, to go spend some time alone with God. There's a big storm on a lake, and everybody is freaking out. Everybody's in turmoil. And Jesus says what? He's sleeping on the little carpet and the pillow in the front of the boat. Other people are working hard, and Jesus is just fine taking a nap. They're hard, struggling at the oars, and Jesus didn't feel like he had to be the one rowing the boat either or do anything to save everybody in that moment. There's a story where Jesus meets this woman, and he's by a well, and we think it's a phenomenal story, but don't ever forget, Jesus is sitting at that well because he wanted to rest. And what did he do? He sent his friends on to work. Jesus had no problem saying, I'm in a rest, you guys can go do the work for a while. I was fine with him. And it totally flies in the face of the way most of us think about having to, you know, Western, white, you know, Protestant work ethic of go, go, do. That's our invention. There's this great bumper sticker. You may have seen it before. It says, Jesus is coming. Look busy. You know, if the king of the universe is coming, you better not be sleeping under the apple tree. But you know what? I don't think God has any problem if you are. And this is why. God's not a workaholic. I don't think he expects you to be one either. And I certainly think that there's no way you're really going to enjoy the richness of life the way God intended it for us to enjoy if you're just busy all the time. Jesus, think of the banquets and the weddings he went to, the feasts that he had with people. He was not, he took time to enjoy being around other people. When he describes what the kingdom of God is like, how many different times does he describe it as a feast, as a banquet? Why? Because it's about spending time, not working, not doing other things. He doesn't say the kingdom of God is like a person who went out and slaved all day, right? It's their life is supposed to be rich and full of enjoyment with the people that we love, relaxing. We don't have to kill ourselves. God didn't do it. He doesn't expect you to do it either. Well, we don't always get what we want, and one of the things you can find is Jesus' rest gets interrupted regularly, but it doesn't mean that he didn't make time for it. But he's not going to get it right here, and there's a good reason why. Jesus, as the boat lands, there's this huge crowd of people, just like there always is. It's interesting, though. Notice how he reacts. He has compassion on them. Have you ever had plans to go do something, relax, enjoy yourself, and there's a pressing need and you see it, and rather than having compassion on the people, your first reaction is, oh, great, got to take care of another thing. I love this about Jesus. He's genuinely trying to take care of himself and his friends, and they're interrupted. And he doesn't always do this, but he stops here and he sees them, and he has compassion on them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. Isn't this interesting that Jesus' compassion for these people is to start teaching them? And if you read through the scriptures, you can find out what does Jesus teach? Well, he talks a lot about who God is. He talks about what God has done for us, and he talks about what it means for us to live in relationship to God, right? Sort of those things. All of this stuff is really, it's about what? It's about learning how to, there it is, knowing God in a real way, in a personal way. I know people that like go to church on Sunday, and that's where they get their God stuff once a week. Let me ask you a question. So if God designed you, Brian Rosner, you're sitting in the back, and I know you're going to skip out on me soon. So Brian, you're sitting back here, and Leela is sitting way up in the front. So let's just say that If Brian lives most of his life sitting way in the back and Leela way in the front, right, and they rarely ever sit down and connect or do meaningful things together, how rich a relationship are they going to have? Anybody help me with that? There we go. We got one person that understands. You're not going to have a very rich relationship, are you, if you don't spend time with somebody? And see, this is the thing that Jesus is telling us, is it's not enough just to learn a bunch of facts about God, but rich living comes from being connected to God. How can you be connected to someone you don't know? Not very well, can you? See, this is the reason Jesus spends so much time teaching. He sees these lost people, and what does he do? In order to help them experience all that life was supposed to be about, he says, you've got to understand who God is. You've got to know him. You've got to know who he is, what he's done for us, and what it looks like for you to live in connection to him. And if you think you can learn that just by coming to church once a week, your relationship is going to be this far apart. And you're always going to wonder, why am I not experiencing the richness of life the way it was supposed to be? If you were created to live in connection, a rich connection with your Creator, but you're just meeting Him once a week, you're starving yourself, and you're never going to be satisfied. You're never going to experience what life was supposed to be about. I put a quote in your bulletins on that first page at the bottom by John Piper that talks about that very thing. Man, you'll just see God as this, like through a mist. You'll know He's there, but you'll never really understand or get the joy of living connected to Him. This is why Jesus spends so much time. See, He's about to feed them with physical food, but this is why Jesus uses these illustrations of what it means to be satisfied in your life with Him. He calls Himself, He says, I'm the water of life. And if you drink from Me, you'll have a spring dwelling up inside of yourself and you'll be satisfied. He calls Himself the bread of life. Take Me in, consume Me, and you will be full. See, here's the thing. He's going to feed them physically in a minute, but Jesus is not talking right here about physical food to satisfy you. He's saying you've got a soul, and you need to fill it with something. And see, I think that this is what happens. In America, we think, well, if you're not a spiritual person, you're not going to church, you're not seeking after something, you know, some sort of spiritual path, then you're empty. I don't think that's true. I think everybody fills their spirit with something. And the question we ought to really wonder about in our own lives is, what are you filling your soul with? Are you filling it with the richness that God intended for you to experience all that life is about? Or are you polluting it with crap? Or are you filling it with stuff that's just a, you know, like our diets? We can put a lot of sugar in our bodies, but it's just a poor substitute, isn't it, for real nutrients, the way God intended for us to live. And people will seek after these spiritual paths, being sure that that's what's really going to fill them up, only to find out that it's really just a poor substitute. It may look like the real thing, but it's just a poor substitute for the real thing that God, and God alone, through the person of Jesus, offers us. Tony Campolo says this so well. He says that everybody has both physical and spiritual needs. And talking about Westerners, he goes on to say, as consumers, he says, we're the one culture that tries to meet spiritual needs with material goods. You know, a lot of times in the absence of trying to fill our souls with something of value that will really nourish us the way God intended, we think that if I just have one more physical thing, if I have a nice boat to be able to enjoy the lake, if I have another vacation home in San Diego so when the weather's bad in Tahoe, I can go to there, if I just have more sex, if I just have more, fill in the blank. And we sometimes think that the way to find real satisfaction in life, to fill up that void in our life, is through physical things. And God made us, see, this is the key, God made us not just physical beings, but He made us all spiritual beings. And we have a hunger to have both of those things filled. And there are certainly physical things that have to satisfy our physical hunger, but there's also spiritual things. And we need to fill it with what God originally intended if we're going to experience the richness of life the way He designed for us to. Well, this is interesting because the day is getting longer, and Jesus has been teaching and filling their soul. And the disciples recognize, hey, the people are probably getting hungry here too. So this is what they say to Jesus. They say, send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding countryside and the villages to buy themselves something to eat. Now, I just want to stop. I'm going to ask you a question. I'm looking for an answer here. Does this seem like a legitimate concern and a legitimate way to deal with that concern, what the disciples have here? Yes or no? Greg says no. Greg says no. I got some people saying yes, some people no. And I want to walk through here because I think that yes, it is legitimate, but Jesus doesn't seem to think so, and I want to talk about why. So I want to explain for a minute about how we see in this picture about how Jesus lives, about just how unbelievably generous God is, and just how unbelievably stingy Noah is. And I want to talk about how if we want to enjoy the richness of life, generosity, and generosity God's way, it's a necessity. Here's the thing. So I think what the disciples see here in this situation is they're being honest. I don't think they're lying. I want to walk through this with you and think about a couple of things here. First of all, are they being honest? Well, yes, it was late in the day, and the people are hungry. They have a legitimate physical need that needs to be met. So they're not lying about the situation. These people really are hungry. Secondly, you could ask this question, though. Do the people deserve a free lunch? Let's say that they had means to, let's say the disciples had the means to feed all these people. Does that entitle those people to getting something for free? If they haven't done anything to earn it, and I don't know that they've done anything to earn it, intrinsically, I mean, they're there, they show up, but the fact that they're hungry isn't Jesus' fault, it's not the disciples' fault, it's their fault for coming out there without food, right? So I think that, do the people really deserve a free lunch? Well, I think actually, no, they don't. They should have been responsible, learned how to take care of themselves, not impose on other people to solve their basic problems in life. The other thing is you could say this. Let's say the people fed them. Let's say Jesus does something miraculous for them. Could it be that the people will end up taking advantage of that graciousness and not being thankful and come back again expecting graciousness even if they don't deserve it? Could that be? Oh, you see people shaking their heads. Absolutely it could be. Okay, let me walk back through this. Are there times in Noah's life where he sees people with a legitimate need? Absolutely, yes. First question, yes, I see people who have real physical, spiritual needs. And could I somehow help or participate in being a part of the solution? Absolutely. Are there times in my life where what I do is I look at the person and I go, in fact, this is most of the time how I deal with this sort of situation. I go, well, let me think about this for a minute. How did you get yourself in that situation? It wasn't my fault. I think very oftentimes it's not even somebody else's fault. You are personally responsible for the mess you've made. You don't deserve a free get out of jail. You don't deserve a bailout. And here's the thing I think. If I help them, am I really helping them? Or am I just enabling their bad behavior, their poor choices that they've made? Very often I'll say, look, if I do something, I'm thinking in my head, if I do something to help them out, all I'm doing is alleviating the consequences that they need to learn to be able to help themselves make healthier choices in the future. So I go, hey, man, it's not my job to help you out. In fact, very often I'll say, it's irresponsible for me to help you out. It's not really what's healthy. And is it true that sometimes if I go out of my way to help somebody else, that you know what I'll do is I'll just create a cycle of dependence where they will continue to take care of them, you know, take advantage of my grace or somebody else's grace? Could that be true also? Could that be a reason to say, no, I'm not going to do it? I'm not going to abuse myself or give away something valuable to me that I could give to somebody else in a more valuable way to help someone who doesn't deserve it, who's going to take advantage of my grace. I want you to think about it. That's the way I think a lot of times about life. And I think very oftentimes I tell people, I counsel people to consider living like this. Here's the crazy thing about this. If all of that is true, the people would have gone home hungry. Jesus would not have fed them. See, do the people have a legitimate need? Food? Yes. Did they deserve a free lunch? Probably not. Will Jesus' grace be taken advantage of? Yes. And here's the crazy thing. You can read on in the book of John, and you know what happens? Jesus confronts the people and says, you're following me now because I fed you back here. You're just taking advantage of my good grace. Now, here's the thing. Jesus knew the people were going to do that and still fed them anyways. Oh, this throws my life into a wreck. Are you telling me sometimes I should feed people even though I should bail people out even though they don't deserve it? Are you telling me that sometimes I should give people a free lunch? Are you telling me sometimes that I should allow myself to be taken advantage of? I hate this stuff. I hate this Bible stuff. You better believe it. Jesus, now, understand this. There's a balance to living, and I can show you other places in the Bible where Jesus doesn't deal with every situation like this. But what I do is I use those exceptions to never be generous in the way Jesus is generous right here, and that's not right. That's not the way God calls us to live. That's not a generous way to live. See, being generous sometimes costs us dearly. And I want to tell you how in this passage you can see that real easy. In the Greek, we really miss this. In the Greek, all it says is when Jesus took the bread and he prays for it and then he breaks it, all it says is just two words in the Greek. It just says, bless and broke. That's all he does. He just blesses the bread and then breaks it. Bless, break. Now, if you go a little bit further on in the story of Jesus' life, he's sitting with his friends at this dinner table, and it's his last meal he eats with them. And he takes the bread, and he blesses it and breaks it. And that's all it says, bless, break. What's that all about? I'm the bread, and I will be broken for you. Did the people deserve to have Jesus' body broken for us? I don't think so. See, this is God's amazing, generous grace. And are there times where Noah takes advantage of that grace? Oh, yes, there are. I don't always live in the manner that respects the grace that God's shown me. I'm not telling you have to live your life every minute, every way, abusing yourself and being allowed to be abused at the hand of other people. But if you're not generous like this, occasionally, you might ask yourself, if Jesus is my example, and Jesus shows me how to live a full life the way God designed, a rich life, from time to time, you better be experiencing some of what he did. And that's a radical kind of generosity. It's a radical kind of grace, and it's not the kind of grace and generosity that I practice in my own life very often. Here's the benefit of this, and it's so good. Richard Foster, Celebrate Disciplines, in his book, Money, Sex, and Power, he says, giving with a glad and generous heart has a way of rooting out the old miser within us. Even the poor need to know that they can give. Just the very act of letting go of money or some other treasure, it does something within us. I would say it's healing for us. This is what brings life to us. It destroys the demon of greed. And man, who doesn't need to be alleviated from the grips of that from time to time in our own life? I think the key to being able to live generously the way God does is this, is if you think that you own your time, if you think you own your money, it is difficult to just give it away and be generous and give it freely and give with grace, isn't it? Because you feel like it's yours and you're entitled to it. I earn this, it's mine. But if you really think about life from God's perspective and you go, well, God says he's the author of life. He's the giver of life. He sustains life. So when you recognize that, you go, hey, my life is not my own anyway. So yeah, I'm the rich recipient of this gift that I have. If you think about your money and you go, this isn't just mine because I earned it. This is God's and I'm taking care of it. He's been gracious to give this to me. It makes it a whole lot easier to not hold on to stuff, doesn't it? To be able to live in a way that says, I'm the steward of this stuff. It's God's anyways. I think that makes it a whole lot more easy to be generous in the long run. Well, the story isn't quite over here as we're looking at what it means to live a rich life. And so the disciples, this is what they say, send the people away so that they can go to the surrounding village, countrysides, buy themselves something to eat. Verse 37, this is the key. Remember I told you earlier, I said that this story is in all four of the books about Jesus' life, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. It's a rare story. Not very many of these stories told in all four of these. And there's a little different take on each one of them. The details are slightly different in terms of what each author focused on. But there's one line in there that is exactly the same in all four of them, and it's this one, verse 37. It says, but Jesus answered them, you give them something to eat. Isn't it interesting that in the midst of the situation that's overwhelming 5,000 plus people, the people recognize there's a problem, and Jesus doesn't say, I'll take care of it. You don't have to do anything. What does he do? He offers an invitation for the people to take part in bringing about the help, that the ministry that people need to be able to meet their needs. Now, you might think, well, gee, this isn't a very good, nice way to offer people to help out here, Jesus. Surely there's something that they could have done with a little more success than this. Now, this is a little overwhelming. This might be a little bit like your life. This might be a little bit like the church. Are there times where you feel overwhelmed, like I don't have the ability to be able to take care of whatever the needs are that are faced before me of helping, serving other people? You ever feel like that? The church, we feel like this all the time, that we don't have enough time, we don't have enough physical resources, whether it's people or money or whatever. Very oftentimes we feel like we don't even have enough talent to be able to really adequately address whatever issues are in front of us. So does that mean I just get to wash my hands and say, go away? See, that's what Jesus says here. There's a problem, and even though it seems overwhelming, he's saying, what can you do to be a part of the solution? See, this is the thing about life. Life is overwhelming, and we feel overwhelmed. But that doesn't give us the excuse just to say, go away. This is the invitation God gives us to be a part of the work that he's doing, restoring and rescuing all things. And very often, as you may feel overwhelmed in that. And in that case, you can do what these guys should have done and said, help me! I'm convinced that would have been okay. I'm convinced it would have been okay if they had said, we're overwhelmed here, but we've got you on our side. You're on our team. And because of that, there's no challenge we can't meet. I'm convinced that would have been a totally adequate answer in this response. So it talking about, you know, living a rich life and these principles that this invitation that's offered to us, I'll close real quick here, and I want you to think about just in your own life, you know, surely one of these areas is helpful for you to think about how to enjoy all that life is supposed to be. The first thing is if you're like me, you are a workaholic, and I feel guilty when I'm not busy. I passed Doug Rosner this last week, and Doug rolled down his window, and we're talking at the stoplight, and Doug said, how are you doing? You must be busy, because I'm always busy. And I said, actually, this is not too bad a week for me. And I almost felt guilty saying that, you know, like I'm not going crazy right now. I feel like I ought to be consumed. And you know what? I need for health in my life and to enjoy the richness that God called and allows me to enjoy. I've got to find a better balance in my own life. The second thing is, it's easy to learn a lot of information about God, but that's totally different than actually knowing God, than feasting on him, allowing him to fill your soul by spending time with him, and allowing that knowledge to shape the choices that you make and how you live your life. The third thing is, and this might be the hardest thing for most of us, is how can I really genuinely learn to be more generous the way God is? This model that he portrays in this picture. If I'm gonna take this invitation to enjoy a rich life, I mean, can you think about it this for a minute? Can you honestly say, if you give, just think of your time, how much time you have in a week, a month, a year. If you give 2%, 3% of your time away to help other people, do you have the gall to say you're being generous? I mean, does that really cut it in terms of thinking about what it means to live a rich, generous life? If you look at your tax return at the end of the year and you see 2% or 3% of your income goes towards helping serve God's purposes in the larger world, do you have the gall to say to other people or to God himself, I'm being generous? I would never assume to stand before God and call looking at how he lives and what he does, his model of generosity, and then standing before him and saying, 3% this year, you know what I mean? I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that. I can't imagine somebody else would feel like, hey, that's generous living. And here's the thing. Look, it's not even about patting yourself on the chest or the back. This is just about enjoying life. I'm convinced God made us to live like Jesus said. I came into the world. My purpose isn't to kill, steal, and destroy like the thief. It's to give life. And he shows us, he teaches us how to do that. The question is, are you willing to adjust your life? Are you willing to shape it in a way that says, yes, you're the Lord. You set this up. You're the maker, and I belong to you, and I'll do this. And I know that I won't find the fullness of life any other way. This is the invitation he gives us to enjoy a rich life. God, thanks for the opportunity we have to get together today. Thanks for Mother's Day. I think it's just my own mom and what a great gift she was to me and how rich she makes my life and how little I really appreciate or ever took advantage of that great gift you gave me growing up. And Lord, I feel like sometimes that's true in my life with you too. An incredible gift and resource that you are to me, and I'm not always grateful or thankful and allow you to shape me the way you desire. Lord, you did this so that we can enjoy all that life is supposed to be. Lord, allow us to enjoy the rich life that you purposed for us. In Jesus' name, amen.